Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, community gardens as an antidote to food deserts and health crises. Then, as Europe's crisis continues to affect millions of people, labor unions have waged massive strikes. What is Europe's economic future? Finally, so-called memory entrepreneurs try to change how we remember the past in efforts to shape the future. But did they lose the Cold War memory fight? Throughout the U.S., pockets of communities are considered food deserts, where residents have limited access to healthy food. At the same time, an epidemic of obesity and related illnesses, like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, are at crisis levels. Community gardens are emerging as one possible solution, in which people can grow food and learn at the same time. One project focused on children has just emerged in Los Angeles. Little Green Fingers is working with children under 5 to grow their own food and learn firsthand about nutrition. Nicole Gatto joins us. She's an epidemiologist and health science researcher at the University of California, Los Angeles, to tell us about the project. Welcome, Nicole Gatto.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're a health expert, and you've seen and studied the health issues, particularly around cardiovascular issues.
Right.
What is it that you're seeing that you're considering to be a crisis now?
I'm an epidemiologist, and when I was working on my doctoral dissertation, which focused on cardiovascular disease, I moved into a food desert neighborhood in Northeast Los Angeles. And a food desert is a neighborhood where there is really a reduced access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And really, if you look at the landscape, you'll see that fast food restaurants dominate. When I was living in this neighborhood, I had the opportunity to start a community garden. And during the 3 years that I was involved, I really saw the transformation of the neighborhood. And I really saw the positive benefits of this garden on our neighbors' health in the community. And I've gone on to work on starting school gardens now aimed at improving health of our elementary school age children in Los Angeles.
In terms of the health issues and the health impact, have you seen something measurable?
There's been an incredible awareness building of the obesity epidemic in the United States. And over the last 30 years, this problem has really grown into a major public health issue. And today, the statistics are that more than 30% of U.S. adults are obese. What is really most concerning and equally alarming is that the obesity epidemic has now reached our children. And according to the most recent statistics from the CDC, approximately 17% of children aged 2 through 19 are obese. So the causes of obesity on an individual level really relate to what we eat and how much we eat and our sedentary lifestyles. But also on a community level, there's the lack of access to green spaces and parks, and also the lack of access to healthy, fresh food options, for example, in food desert neighborhoods. With this new project, the Little Green Fingers Project, our goal is by putting in community gardens in food desert neighborhoods to be able to evaluate their impact on the health of the youngest residents of Los Angeles, those age 0 to 5.
And I noticed that with your first project that you integrated, in addition to the farming, art and education as well.
Right. The goal of our community garden was really to be comprehensive. So we wanted to integrate both urban farming, art and education as part of the goal of our garden.
This is moving into work with the LA Unified School District with your project.
Right. My LA Sprouts project is slated to start 4 school gardens in Los Angeles Unified, and then we will be using those gardens to host an after-school cooking, nutrition, and gardening program for 12 weeks that is aimed, again, at reducing the risk of obesity in particularly Latino elementary school-aged children.
Now, there are other projects like this going on around the United States. Have you seen some connection across some of these projects?
There's a lot of amazing projects out there in the United States. Few of them have integrated a research angle. So while there's a lot of anecdotal information, there's a lot of reason to believe that gardens can have a positive impact on your health. There's not a lot of data out there to support it. So our LA Sprouts program, the idea is to conduct a randomized trial. So we have students who serve as a comparison group while a main group of students are receiving the intervention.
You said that you have taken a page from the Nobel winner Wangari Maathai, right, who had founded the Green Belt Movement. Talk to us about how this connects.
Wangari Maathai has been one of my biggest inspirations for the work that I'm doing. I just think that the work that she did in Africa is incredible with establishing the Green Belt Movement. Also, the work of our First Lady has been an incredible inspiration both for myself and I think for other folks who are involved in this field across the country. I just came across mention of a recent study that looked at tree canopy size and crime in urban areas in the United States. And I think that this type of work and the work of Wangari Maathai really speaks to the importance of green aspects to our urban environments and how they can relate to health, both physical, mental, psychological benefits.
In other words, when you're in an environment that is full of nature and very green and very healthy, perhaps we're reducing some of those negative impacts?
Correct. We are convinced anecdotally that if you grow your own food, you are also more likely to eat it.
One question regarding these food desert. When we had Will Allen here and he talked about one of the complications about doing these urban gardens was that the ground was often contaminated. So he was doing raised gardens and developing his own soil with worms and compost. Is that anything that you have had to deal with?
In any urban area, one has to contend with the past consequences of our urban environment, for example, leaded fuel. So we did find in one of the projects that I worked on that there was a particular level of a contaminant from previous pesticide use, and we just had to work around it. So, raised bed gardens are a great way to do that. So you actually are using soil above ground, and the contact with the existing soil is minimized. The other alternative is to do remediation techniques, so techniques that you can do over time that actually heal the soil and remove those contaminants out of it.
And finally, how old are the kids?
Are we speaking about our LA Sprouts, or are we speaking about our Little Green Fingers?
Oh, well, I thought they were connected.
The Little Green Fingers Project is particularly targeting children aged 0 to 5, so the youngest residents of Los Angeles County. And the reason why we've targeted these young children is because, again, we know from anecdotes and also from research that children's eating habits are formed when they're young. So we're really trying to reach these kids from out of the gate, literally. So we're trying to shape their eating habits when they're young. So Little Green Fingers, it's a collaboration which is spearheaded by the Los Angeles Conservation Corps, and it's funded by First Five Los Angeles. In this project, we're going to be developing 8 community gardens spread out across Los Angeles County over the next 5 years. We're specifically targeting food desert neighborhoods with higher populations of 0 to 5-year-old children than the average in Los Angeles County. The gardens will be improving access to healthy fruits and vegetables, and we predict that they will provide a minimum of 6,000 pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables each year. And we, in the consideration of our designs, we are adding amenities and programs that will target families with children aged 0 to 5.
The other thing that I think is quite fascinating, potentially, is that these young kids are then learning about the actual kind of magic of the soil, like you put seeds in it and things grow.
It's been incredible to see the reception with kids. Kids who may not have had exposure to gardening previously for whatever reason, they may live in apartments, or it may be just the fact that we are so far removed from what it takes to grow our own food. So just the looks on kids' faces when they pull up a turnip and they see the actual plant, know that then they can prepare it into something yummy. It's just an incredible, incredible experience.
So it actually teaches them a bit about the environment as well.
Correct.
With a hands-on approach.
Exactly. So part of our work, we do believe that it's important for children to have a hands-on experience that really impacts their learning in a very meaningful way.
Thank you so much, Nicole Gatto.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. With massive strikes across several European countries, labor unions have collectively expressed their displeasure about the handling of the European economic crisis. Joblessness is in double digits across several countries, such as Italy, Portugal, Spain, and Greece. And in the latter two, a quarter of the population is unemployed. What is the future of Europe's economy? We are joined by Carl Carl Kaltenthaler, professor of political science and director of research at the University of Akron. He's the author of The Politics of Policymaking in the European Central Bank and Germany and the Politics of Europe's Money. Chris Tilley is also with us. He's a professor of urban planning and the director of the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. He is the co-author of Stories Employers Tell, Race, Skills, and Hiring in America, and Glass Ceilings and Bottomless Pits, Women's Work, Women's Poverty. Welcome, Carl Kaltenthaler, and welcome, Chris Tilley. Carl Kaltenthaler, let's start with you. Could you give us a review of how we have gotten to this point with this European crisis?
The crisis really has its roots in a couple of different things that go back several years. One of the roots is not so dissimilar to the crisis that we've had here. In some of the European countries, you had a housing bubble develop, and that housing bubble burst, just as it did here, causing some very negative effects in the economies of several of the European countries. Countries that come to mind that had this kind of problem were Ireland, Spain, some others. Other countries have suffered from being basically the recipients of a lot of loans that at the time when they took those loans out seemed like good bets for them. There was good growth going on in Europe. Interest rates were low. So you had governments like the Greek government borrow a lot of money. They figured they'd be able to pay it back. But then the economic crisis of 2008 hit and growth dipped substantially in Europe. And a lot of these governments, Greece in particular, but it was not necessarily a Greek problem, this was a European problem, began to suffer from an inability to pay back the loans. And the problem was that growth dipped, their markets for exports dipped, and markets, very importantly, markets started to really worry about the Greeks and other governments' ability to pay back loans. And so the financial crisis became an economic crisis, which then became a fiscal crisis in the sense that governments went to the international markets to borrow money so that they could pay their basic necessities that they were used to providing for their citizens, pensions, you know, infrastructure, being able to pay the public employees, things like that, many, many different functions that governments performed. They had to go to these markets and borrow money to be able to pay for these things. And it soon became a problem that the debt that they had run up was so great that they couldn't pay back the creditors who they had borrowed money from. And so they had to go then to the European level and start to borrow money. They borrowed money from European Central Bank, from this troika of the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and also the International Monetary Fund, which isn't a European institution, but kind of helped out along the way. Particularly generous were the Germans. The German government gave quite a bit of money to bail out these various indebted European governments. In kind of the demand part of the equation, the Germans said, well, and other governments that gave money as well, said that if we give this money, we expect austerity measures to be put in place. And so governments that got this money had to put austerity measures in place to cut down on how much money they were spending so that they could get themselves back in the black instead of the red. And this has led to some real belt tightening on the part of many of these southern European governments, to the extent that lots of people have been let go who were employed by the government. There's lots of funding that's no longer going to various things that the government had funded previously, which is ratcheting up the unemployment problem right as demand in Europe is going down, as it is worldwide, because of a second global slowdown. We're not quite in a global recession yet, but we're certainly seeing some slowing down of growth. So now you've got a situation in some countries like Spain and Greece where you've got 25% unemployment, and it's actually 50% if you just look at youth unemployment, and the government there are being asked to spend even less. So it looks as if there'll be even more unemployment. And the economic outlook is not good for these countries. The economic outlook is actually pretty grim. Things are going to get worse before they get better. And so in response, these unions that we see striking now are sending a message to their governments, and they're sending a message to the European level as well, saying, look, we've had it with these austerity measures. They're just too tough on the people. Austerity is actually cutting down the growth that these governments need in order to generate revenue to be able to pay back the creditors. So from the union's perspective, not only are people being hurt by the austerity, but they're actually hurting the government's ability to get themselves out of this fiscal hole that they've got.
Chris Tilley.
Well, I think there's a strong analogy with the discussion about the deficit in the United States. So at this point, it seems like both the Republicans and the Democrats are fixated on reducing the deficit and sort of the uncontrolled expansion of the deficit and the debt. They're basically saying, well, if we can get this under control, then it'll help to right the economy again. That's exactly backwards. As Carl was explaining in the case of Europe, the problem is not that sort of out-of-control government spending or even not enough taxing has created this hole by itself, but that we've also had a recession, growth has been slow, and that means that government has to spend more for all the things that government spends during recession, and less is coming in taxes. So the idea that our first priority has to be closing the deficit, which is our version of austerity, is a way, potentially, of just driving our economy right back into recession. But for some reason, that's being viewed as the political priority. It's a similar process in Europe, where the Germans in particular have said, hey, you know, we've been balancing our budget, everybody else has to balance theirs, and not recognizing that what's going on is that in the context of a recession, this kind of austerity, budget balancing, is going to worsen the problem of slow growth, insufficient demand, therefore even less taxes received, and even more money needing to be spent on unemployment insurance and all the things that, you know, all the kinds of spending that kick in a recession. So it's a very parallel discussion to what has unfolded in the United States. I mean, it was going on well before the presidential election. The discussion is now framed around the fiscal cliff, and this focus on, call it austerity, call it balancing the budget, at a time when the economy is so imbalanced and the priority should be growth, is really misguided.
There are a couple of contrasts with the United States. 25% unemployment in Spain is really high, and the numbers that Carl Kaltenthaler just gave us with the youth, I think you said 60%.
Yeah, about 50, but 60 is not unreasonable. The problem is getting worse before it's going to get better. And I think the analogy that Professor Tilley is making to the U.S. is very good. The major difference is that the United States is one country with one political system. The problem in Europe is that you've got an economic union without a political union. And so, to use an American analogy here, think, for example, California has a major debt problem. And let's just dream that Ohio's flush with cash, where I live. And California asks Ohio for money. They say, look, we're in a real fiscal crisis here. Can you please bail us out so that we don't have a default and creditors won't touch us with a 10-foot pole, which is kind of the situation that you're facing in Europe. Assume that in the United States, Ohio could tell California, no, forget about it. Our voters will never agree to bail you guys out. It would just be too politically costly for the governor of Ohio to help California out. That's the situation that you see in Europe right now, with the Germans basically saying, look, we can't give more money. And in fact, what's being called for now is for another managed bailout, kind of a mini default for Greece, to basically forgive some of its debt. And the estimates are now that that would cost the Germans about $25 billion. Now, if Angela Merkel goes to the German electorate and says, well, in order to save Greece, that bailout money that we gave, well, we're not going to get about $25 billion of that back. That was wasted money. Of course, you wouldn't say it that way, but the people who are anti-bailout, and there are a lot of them in Germany, would frame it that way. You know, that would be a politically disastrous thing. And so a lot of this is driven by domestic politics. You've got the richer countries in Northern Europe who've had some pretty tight fiscal discipline, who've been pretty lucky because of export markets and things like that, and then you've got the poor countries in Southern Europe who are in a real bind right now, who are depending on the domestic political situation in these Northern European countries, particularly in Germany, to bail them out. This is the central problem. This is now very, very much a political problem, not just an economic problem.
Now with the labor unions in several countries coming together, having a general strike, the general strike has been planned for, I understand, about a year. Chris Tilley, do you know how it actually came about?
Part of the process of European unification has been building ties among European unions. So I don't know the details of how it was organized, but since at this point workers can move freely from country to country within Europe, and companies can certainly move freely, and it's a free trade zone. Unions have, both by choice and by necessity, formed fairly strong alliances. Now, the reports that I've seen suggest that the general strike has been strongest in the southern European countries that have been hit hardest, so places like Spain, Greece, Portugal, to some extent France. There's not a lot of people in the street in Germany and Austria. But yeah, this level of coordination is not surprising. But as Professor Kaltenthaler was putting out, there's no sort of political arena for this kind of discussion to happen Europe-wide at this point. There is a European Parliament, but it's relatively powerless. It's nothing like the Congress of the United States. And at this point, these key economic decisions are being made country by country, which basically is not a workable way to deal with a region-wide and even global crisis.
In terms of general strikes, we haven't seen that many. It seems like sort of a last resort.
It's meant to be a shot across the bow of the government in southern Europe, and also to send a signal to the German government that labor will not take this lying down. There's been a fair amount of unrest in Greece since the austerity measures have been put into place for the last several months, but it's not been on this level in other European countries, and certainly not as coordinated. This is something definitely new. Whether it's going to really make a big difference or not is an open question. I think I would say that it's probably not going to make a big difference, because I think still what's going to trump these strikes is going to be the domestic political situation in countries like Germany. It's not too far off until elections in Germany. The German population, from public opinion polls that we've seen, is very sour on this idea of extending more money to the indebted southern European countries. They're sour on the idea of debt write-offs, that they simply just forgive this debt. And frankly, that's what's going to have to happen if there's going to be really a resolution to this. In some ways, this situation is akin to, you know, what we saw in lesser developed countries starting in the 1980s, where you had this just massive debt crisis balloon into an international crisis, and then governments had to write a lot of this off. Banks had to take it on the chin and write a lot of this debt off. But because of the politics of this in Europe, that's going to be very difficult to do.
Because of Germany, you mean?
Yeah, because convincing the German electorate that they simply have to absorb these costs will be very difficult, next to impossible. I mean, the Germans like to think of themselves as good Europeans, but they're also people who believe strongly in fiscal discipline. It's part of the, we can speak of it as the national ethos. You know, Germany went through a horrendous hyperinflation in the 1920s, and there's just been a very strong kind of historical lesson in Germany that a country has to keep its fiscal house in order, there can be some very nasty consequences. And so there's been general consensus in Germany, on the right and the left, that fiscal discipline is an important thing for governments to try to achieve. And it's certainly something that the German population believes in, if we can believe the public opinion polls that have come out over the years. And I've looked at this in my own research on Germany, and we see it now. We see there's just really strong opposition to the idea of giving more money to these southern European countries. And so I think Europe's at a real impasse right now. You've got Europe facing its own kind of fiscal cliff, and because there is no political union, it's going to be very difficult for Europe to get out of this in a way that's not going to leave it deeply damaged.
Do you think, Karl Kaltenthaler, that there's still the possibility of a collapse of the euro?
I do think it is possible. I don't necessarily think it's probable. I think it is possible, and it also depends on what you mean by collapse of the euro. If you mean that some countries are forced by default to leave the eurozone, I think that's definitely more likely than a complete collapse of the eurozone. I think Greece's ability to stay in the eurozone is probably less today than it was, say, a year ago. That's my personal view, that I think the Greeks are really facing a very, very tough road. We're talking about their debt increasing to 190% of their GDP next year. Now, that's supposed to go down, but the things that they would have to do to reduce that substantially are very, very difficult for the population to be able to handle. And it's also going to be difficult for markets to be reassured that Greece is a decent bet, even with all this help from other countries and from European institutions and things like that. So the Greeks leaving, I think, is a possibility. Now, the economic cost of the Greeks leaving the eurozone would be truly catastrophic for them, and there's talk of a 50% reduction in their GDP as a consequence of them leaving the Eurozone. So there is a chance that some of these countries may leave, but the economic and the political consequences would be very, very dire.
Chris Tilley.
Well, I think there's two other things that are important to add to the picture. One is that, yes, a central part of the problem is the lack of a unified European political forum. But another part of the picture is that when Bill Clinton was president, was trying to sort of retire the huge deficits that have been run up by Reagan and Bush 1, he said, if I was going to be reincarnated, I'd want to come back as the bond market, because that's the most powerful thing around. And I think that's part of what's going on here, is that the bond market, essentially, to give loans to, you know, Greece, Spain, and so on, is saying, we don't have faith that you'll repay. There's sort of a certain amount of speculation and hysteria going on. And just like happened in the East Asian lending crisis, 97, 98, and the Latin American lending crisis of the 80s, there's been a process where this debt has gotten much, much more expensive because lenders are freaking out. Now, it is completely possible for Europe to get together and say, you know what, lenders, you have to take a haircut. That happened to some extent in this country after banks and housing markets collapsed. It didn't happen as much as it could have, but some lenders were told, you know what, you're just not going to get everything you were owed. We're going to hammer out a deal here because we've had an economic crisis. Now, there's not a lot of appetite for taking on that fight either in Europe. That's not a charge that Angela Merkel wants to lead, but I think that it's important to realize that that's a political decision, too, to say, well, we're going to hold the line as much as possible on just downgrading this debt and saying you're going to get a small fraction back of what you loaned, and that's life. And we're just going to shrink the debt until this problem becomes manageable. So that's one piece that's important to mention. The second is, I agree with Professor Kaltenthaler that the unions do not have a strong hand at this point. At this point, what you could call neoliberalism, sort of more of a free market approach, an austerity approach, really does have the upper hand in Europe and, as I mentioned earlier, in the United States. On the other hand, what's at stake here is, to some extent, the kind of labor-capital truces that were worked out in the last century. So in the United States, we had the New Deal, where we had, you know, Social Security, we had unemployment insurance, we had the recognition of unions, and that was sort of the deal that was struck between capital and labor at a certain point, and it has unraveled to some extent since then. And the idea that we're going to start undoing Social Security and Medicare would be, again, an attack on that truce. The European countries also had truces of these kinds at various points, depending on their histories. After fascism, after the end of dictatorship, in some cases there were truces that had been worked out in the 1930s that persist to this day. But workers are really trying to defend some of the things that were put in place in that long-term truce between labor and capital, that there's, you know, some basic Social Security safety nets, that there's a, you know, decent retirement packages. In Southern Europe, there tend to be protections against firing because there's not as strong a system of unemployment insurance. In Northern Europe, it tends to be more unemployment insurance and so on. There's sort of a package of things that labor and capital worked out nationally in country after country, and to some extent, under the banner of austerity, that's being rolled back. So when workers are saying, we're ready to defend this to whatever it takes, they're not just talking about, you know, a few euros here or there or pay cuts. They're talking about really sort of losing their grip on something that a lot of people struck and died and, you know, fought very hard to achieve over decades and decades in the last century.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to end. Chris Tilley, director of UCLA's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, and Carl Kaltenthaler, professor of political science, director of research projects, and faculty fellow at the University of Akron, also author of The Politics of Policymaking in the European Central Bank and Germany and the Politics of Europe's Money. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned.
I was born by the river, in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Can reconfiguring our memories of the past affect the future? Has memory itself become a political battleground? Some political scientists have found that so-called memory entrepreneurs try to reshape our memories as a means to advance particular policy agendas. One of these battles has been the effort to shape our memories of the Cold War, to have it remembered as a good fight, like World War II, in which good triumphed over evil. How has this battle been waged? And has it been successful? John Wiener joins us now. He's a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, and his latest, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Ellen Schrecker is also with us. She is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of several books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and The Age of McCarthyism, A Brief History with Documents. Doug Becker is also with us. He is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Among his publications are The Bush Administration's Campaign Against the International Criminal Court and also The Use of Memory and Trauma in Foreign Policymaking, which has been Memory and Trauma in International Relations. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar's Circle. It's great to have you. Doug Becker, I want to start with you. You put this idea of official memory and shaping historical memory into a political context, almost like a political tool, and it's changed over the years. How would you say it has been changing, and what have been the effects?
Thank you for having me. History is certainly not static by any stretch of the imagination. Our understandings are the lessons that we draw from history, even certainly questions about causations within history will change. And although any good historian will certainly tell you they'll change because evidence is changing and because our knowledge of patterns from the past have changed, also there are social and political causes for those change. Specifically, history is used by contemporary political actors. It's certainly a component for contemporary political actors about shaping identity, about learning lessons from the past, about trying to blunt criticism for current policies, trying to draw linkage between your current policy preferences and something that happened in the past. Some of this is natural. I mean, the idea that contexts of history, the lessons of history, the meanings within history will change generationally, will change over the years, is a natural organic process. But it's not always simply natural and organic. And there are certainly individuals with vested political interests in either maintaining old historical narratives are creating new historical narratives, adjusting the contemporary narratives. The term that we use for those are memory entrepreneurs. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is, first, why would a memory entrepreneur try to alter our understandings within history, try to create a new narrative? But also, I want to caution us that an attempt to alter history by a memory entrepreneur doesn't alter it. What it does is it creates an arena of political contestation. And sometimes it becomes dialectical, left versus right, and you know, something that Hegel would certainly be proud of. But in some cases, it can be very multifaceted. And the ways in which political actors will take these attempts at altering history, either to directly confront it, reject it, or manipulate it for their own benefits. So the lessons here is, if history's changing, asks whose interest is it to change? Who's trying to change it? And then how can contemporary political actors go with these changes to serve their current political preferences?
Ellen Schrecker, would you agree with this?
I think so, though I think the way Doug is presenting this is as if there are sort of individuals out there with some kind of agenda. And I think it's much more a question of what can history be used for. I'm just teaching a course now. We're just getting up to Vietnam. I teach contemporary American history. And this is the moment at which American policymakers, in order to justify a military escalation in Vietnam, begin to talk about Munich. That's the lesson that they want to bring from history to show that we've got to stand up to whatever it is we have to stand up to. You can do almost anything with history to justify a current practice. But in the hands of policymakers, you see often a distortion and a focus on certain lessons and a totally ignoring other lessons or other moments.
Well, that's actually the perfect place to bring in John Wiener, who's just written this book, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America, which speaks to this exactly.
I love Doug's concept of memory entrepreneurs. And one of the things I was interested in my book, How We Forgot the Cold War, was the efforts of, in particular, mainstream conservative memory entrepreneurs to shape the public understanding of the Cold War. The idea they presented is a very coherent one, a very comprehensive one. The Cold War, you may have heard this before, was a battle between freedom and slavery, between good and evil. The United States triumphed because one man in particular, Ronald Reagan, remained true to his values and refused to compromise with evil, unlike certain other people we could mention. Richard Nixon, for example, with détente. Reagan went to the Brandenburg Gate. Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And they did. Good triumphed over evil, the end. In my book, I set out on a trip across the United States to visit monuments and museums and memorials about the Cold War to see how this message was going over with the public. And what I found was that the public wasn't really remembering the Cold War at all. The public was forgetting about the Cold War, that the efforts of the, let's call them Reaganite memory entrepreneurs in this case, don't seem to have succeeded. I found somewhere between, I don't know, skepticism, apathy, and maybe some resistance to this notion.
You spoke specifically, or you wrote, I should say, specifically about this legacy resource management program. What was the scope of this?
That sounds kind of bureaucratic, doesn't it?
I mean, was it just these memorials or was there more to it?
This was like the very day that the Soviet Union collapsed. Congress was aware and passed legislation in the Defense Appropriation Act, we're in 1991 now, to create the public memory of the Cold War. And this was not just through museums, monuments, memorials, but through archival records and all kinds of things that we want them to do. Clearly, they were aware of the political value of creating a certain definition of the Cold War. And I want to emphasize, I've been calling this the Reaganite definition, but really it was completely bipartisan. I'm sure when Ellen Schrecker teaches this course, she teaches the Democrats were just as much a part of this idea that we need to have a nuclear deterrent to defend freedom and that the military budgets are an unfortunate necessity. And starting with Harry Truman in 1947, right through Bill Clinton, we find bipartisan consensus about the importance of conveying to the public this way of understanding the Cold War and what it means.
Ellen Schrecker?
It's a very highly militarized notion of the Cold War, which I think is a lot of what John was finding, that so many of these places that he was visiting were on military bases, had something to do with this militarization of American foreign policy that the Cold War brought about. And that's something that obviously falls away when we talk about the Cold War, because it's often presented, I know I see this with my own students, as a kind of morality play. And a lot of what is popular history out there does come through in a very oversimplified, you know, good guys versus bad guys kind of way that drives historians up the wall. This is not the way we like to think about history.
Doug Becker, you have done quite a bit of research on Reagan and the development of his legacy. You had a name for it, too. I think it was called something like the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project. How does this comport with what you found?
No, it actually fits it rather well. There's one point I want to make about this question of the morality play. One of the great ironies is certainly within international relations, the traditional school of realism, and who's always credited with being the father of containment, George Kennan, always complained about the moral components of containment and the way the morality play plays itself out, which raises an interesting question when we create a history that the reason why the U.S. won the Cold War was because of containment, because of hard-headed you know, hard-reasoned rationalist policies, when in reality, both the historians and the policymakers themselves seem to be rather emotional in that response. But to your question about the Reagan Legacy Project, yeah, I mean, the idea that you would finger an individual, at one level, certainly individuals have a key role to play, but it's rare that a single individual could have a significant impact. But in the case of the Reagan Legacy Project, there actually was. It was the brainchild, at least in its contemporary form, of Grover Norquist, who we all know quite well. And it was in 1997, and the direct political interest in his project was a collective coming to grips with the fact that they just lost a second presidential election to Bill Clinton and wanted to emphasize that Ronald Reagan was the direct opposite of Clinton, that he was moral. You know, he stuck to his guns. He was the sort of leader that stood by moral guideposts. And at one level, what Norquist wanted to do was name one thing after Ronald Reagan in every county in America. And that's why you start seeing all these things named. So when you examine the contemporary political motivations for this, the use of Munich as a justification to intervene in any sort of conflict because every individual that might threaten the peace is the new Hitler, and also the militarized response. I'm always struck by the use of, you know, a term that gets used in the neoconservative community is a neo-Reaganite foreign policy. And they used it to justify military intervention in Iraq, despite the fact, I mean, the historical record is quite clear. The only time Ronald Reagan ever used the military was to invade tiny Grenada. And most historians and political scientists alike believe that that had much more to do with domestic politics and the collective concern about what would happen as a result of the bombing in Beirut, as opposed to freeing this tiny nation of its communist overlord. So,
John Wiener.
I'm very interested in this whole issue of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project and where it stands today. If you go out to Simi Valley, where the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum, this is the white-hot heart of Reagan memory in the world, this is the place, above all others, where we should hear about Reagan's lifelong commitment to fighting evil. If you go there now, what you find is they do have exhibits about Reagan and the Cold War and the Berlin Wall, and there's a little corner about Grenada if you want to read the fine print. But what is big right there now for the next few months is an exhibit on the history of Walt Disney. It's the world's largest collection ever exhibited of Walt Disney artifacts. It's the largest temporary exhibit they've ever had at the Reagan Library. Why? What does this have to do with Ronald Reagan? The answer is virtually nothing. The show is organized not by the National Archives, which operates the Reagan Library, and the mission of the National Archives is to preserve the records and history of the people of the United States of America. This exhibit was organized by the Walt Disney Fan Club. It's got a lot of great stuff if you're interested in Walt Disney. You know, Steamboat Willie's original drawings. There's Snow White. There's Cinderella. All your favorites, Maria.
And when you went there, it was hippie day.
Well, that's another story. That was the last time. I think what we find is that the Reagan Library has kind of lost confidence that people will come out there to hear about Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. They think what people want to hear about is Walt Disney. And indeed, their attendance doubled after they opened the Walt Disney exhibit. So this is a sign that the memory entrepreneurs are not succeeding at their mission and they're having to look elsewhere.
Well, we keep mentioning tear down this wall and crediting Ronald Reagan with this. Ellen Schrecker, perhaps you can set the record straight for us. What did happen? Did Ronald Reagan tear down this wall?
I'm afraid not. But what did happen was that the Soviet Union crumbled from within because of a whole bunch of reasons. It was unsustainable. Technology was back. I mean, you know, all kinds of internal reasons. It was a very rigid system that promoted all kinds of cheating. And what the triumphalist, you know, your true believers in Reagan as the architect of the end of the evil empire, is based on the notion that when Ronald Reagan decides to adopt the technology of Star Wars, which most people probably don't remember. It was something called the Strategic Defense Initiative, and the idea was to create a huge shield of missiles that would shoot down Soviet missiles whenever they came over. Reagan pumps a lot of money in it, essentially daring the Soviets to match him in military spending on this very fancy technology that doesn't seem to work. The idea was that Reagan had kind of spent the Soviet Union into bankruptcy, and that's why the wall came down. It's a much more complicated issue than that and owes a lot more to the inherent problems of the Soviet system than it does to a rather late attempt on the part of Ronald Reagan to, quote-unquote, spend the evil empire into destruction. But this has become the kind of mantra of Cold War triumphalists, that Reagan, by creating this very strange defense system that doesn't work, defeated the Soviet Union.
Doug Becker?
I find it very interesting that the Reagan Library is concerned about trying to get folks to come out there. And the people who I know who've gone out to the library typically go because they want to see the replica of Air Force One that's there. But what I find that's quite striking is the Reagan Triumphal School is certainly a component of political ideology in the United States. Whether the Soviet Union crumbled or Reagan caused it to crumble, how you would answer that question is, I would suspect, is very strongly correlated to general political preferences, whether you're a conservative or liberal, Democrat or Republican. But the thing that I find quite striking is that the lesson of the Triumphal School, that words matter, that ideas matter, and that a speech can change world events, replays itself in the Arab Spring. As Arab governments are certainly being toppled, you, in essence, have both the left and right arguing that their leader, whether it was George Bush's freedom agenda or Barack Obama's speech at Cairo, is the one that's most responsible for that. So both parties are wrapping themselves up in that lesson. But the real concern I had for this was not the question of whether Reagan was a great president or not, but if Reagan was a great president because he ushered in the end of the Cold War, I think most historians and political scientists alike would agree that Reagan's greatness lie not with delivering a speech and refusing to negotiate with evil, but because Reagan recognized that the Soviet Union had changed, that Gorbachev was a different type of leader, someone that the U.S. could do business with. And although that isn't what caused the collapse of the Soviet Union, it certainly advanced American interest with things like the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty and the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties, etc. And the linkages that Gorbachev had with the West certainly constrained the Soviets' policy options once the wall starts to crumble. So if it was deft diplomacy on the part of Reagan and then Bush, how interesting, by the way, Bush is never given credit for the end of the Cold War.
Although he does have a piece of the wall, I understand.
Yeah, apparently. But what's interesting is if there's a lesson to be learned, it's exactly the opposite lesson of things like the Axis of Evil speech, where you declare Iran evil and then say, we're going to stand up, and then Iran's going to get rid of their nuclear program, as opposed to negotiating with Iran. Dare I say, if Reagan were president today, he would be considerably more open to the notion of negotiation with Iran than certainly his conservative descendants would suggest that he would be.
Who often use his name as their representative. So this Reagan idea and the memorial is one of, what, two dozen that John Wiener actually went to and looked at to try to get a sense about this memory that was being shaped, this official memory in how we forgot the Cold War. I was struck by what was included, but also what was left out. We talked about a couple of these before we started the tape. What did you find most remarkable about what was left out and who was left out?
Let me just stick with this Berlin Wall thing for a minute. The Berlin Wall is the great icon of the end of the Cold War and of America's victory in the Cold War and of Reagan going to the Brandenburg Gate and giving his speech. There's something like 40 different places in the United States that display segments of the Berlin Wall. Here, we're in Southern California. there's at least half a dozen spots in Los Angeles or in the LA area that have Berlin Wall exhibits. And indeed, it is a powerful object. And indeed, it did separate a totalitarian state from capitalist democratic state. But when I visited some of these sites around the country, it's just remarkable how many ways the significance of the Berlin Wall is explained and how few of them mention Ronald Reagan. For example, Ellen Schrecker right now speaking to us from Manhattan on East 53rd Street. There's a Westpocket Park that displays a piece of the Berlin Wall. And what the historical marker there says is that this wall marked the border between East and West Germany from 1962 to 1989, period. A border, like the border, I guess, between Canada and the United States. Not the border between slavery and freedom. Not the border between good and evil. That's all they have to say about it. They don't mention Ronald Reagan. There's another segment of it at the Microsoft campus outside of Seattle. Microsoft has a big art collection. They have a piece of the Berlin Wall that they exhibit, and they say they're exhibiting it because it's a work of graffiti art. And indeed, there is graffiti all over most of the Berlin Wall segments. And again, they don't mention Ronald Reagan at all or slavery or freedom. The most remarkable one I found is in Las Vegas at one of the more downscale casinos, the Main Street Station Casino, which is in the, let's call it the budget area of Las Vegas, downtown. They have an exhibit called Pee on the Berlin Wall. And their segment is in the men's room behind the urinals. And they say, gentlemen, pee on the Berlin Wall. It's one of the reasons to go to this casino. So what's left out? Ronald Reagan.
So you've gone to what, to 24?
Something like that.
So about 24 memorials that were dedicated to the Cold War. And if you were going to make a composite of them, and you were going to draw a picture, you as a person who was trying to understand the Cold War by these, what are the big missing pieces and what are the big emphases?
What I found was there's basically three different varieties of these. There's the sort of the true believer exhibits that hold to the, we could call it the Reaganite narrative here. And those are pretty much empty and forlorn and nobody goes there. Nobody wants to hear about it. Then there are the ones that they're sort of entrepreneurial zeal where they change their focus to some other part of history. For instance, there's a Winston Churchill memorial in the middle of Missouri where Churchill gave that famous speech from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, and Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. They built a museum at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, place where he gave that speech, but nobody came. But they changed that museum. Now it is a museum of I have nothing to offer but blood, sweat, and tears. It's about the Battle of Britain. It's about the Royal Air Force. It's about their finest hour. That's the story that people would rather hear about Winston Churchill. They don't really want to hear about the Iron Curtain. And then there's still other places where the Cold War is just a pretext for something completely different. If you drive down the 5 freeway in California to San Diego, there's a huge cross on a hilltop, a 40-foot high cross. The ACLU has been litigating for decades to have this removed. It's on public property and it's a violation of the separation of church and state. The people who built the cross say it's a Korean War memorial. Now, really, it doesn't have anything to do with the Korean War. Really, it is a religious object. But they are using the Cold War as a pretext to defend something which otherwise would get them in trouble.
What I'm gathering from you is this a very disparate story that is being told, and it's not being told very well, and it's not really very convincing. Ellen Schrecker, what do you make of this?
There's some pieces of history that people seem attracted to, and it really follows current political events. For example, the other day, I took my granddaughters to go see the movie about Lincoln. Now, why is a movie about Lincoln coming out now? Obviously, it's pushing 200 years. But I think this movie at this time is also telling us something about race relations in the United States at a moment when we have, for the first time, an African-American president. So I just wonder about a question of timing. What historical moments get dealt with at what times? And it seems to me that popular culture often picks up things that even though sort of what you call triumphalist entrepreneurs or whatever may be pushing, it's not going to get picked up. That there's something else going on, that there's a contemporary story, and if it can get grafted onto some historical moment, then it probably will be.
John Wiener's conclusion was ultimately that this effort has more or less failed, which is clear by How We Forgot the Cold War, the title. But there are some other efforts that seem wildly successful, and we've been speaking about Ronald Reagan. That seems to be one of them. And Doug Becker, you have written about this, how many people invoke Ronald Reagan when they give a speech, how many freeways they try to name after him, and even a mountain. Why do we have such a failure on memory entrepreneurship on the Cold War versus somebody like Ronald Reagan?
There's a couple things going on. First of all, what you're finding with respect to Reagan's role at ending the Cold War and the Cold War itself is this arena of political contestation. There's been a pushback, and at least at one level, I think it's fair to say that the Reagan Triumphal School, that they overplayed their hand by making the argument so blatant and also, quite frankly, so partisan that that's part of the reason for the pushback. Another part, though, I think, is that people aren't terribly interested in the details of the history of the Cold War, yet they've drawn conclusions on how the Cold War has ended and those processes without any sort of background. You ask somebody about the invasion of Grenada, and they'll answer it was to free the country from communists. You ask somebody about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was to free the country from communists. Very, very simple sort of explanation, so that superficially this memory continues. But it's not terribly detailed, it's not terribly deep, it's not terribly nuanced, and it certainly would never meet the standard that any historian would hold it to in terms of being a narrative per se. It's not as much a narrative as, quite frankly, more like a cartoon. It still gets invoked, and it's still this arena of intense contestation, but it is interesting that it's fading, and maybe the lesson here is that memorials aren't terribly successful any longer at the creation of memory.
Well, there are plenty more vignettes that we didn't get to in How We Forgot the Cold War, and some very important ones, I thought, John Wiener, including the, as we talked about, the CIA memorial and the Second Security Memorial, very
National
important.
National Security Agency in Maryland has
and
a
the,
museum.
And the memorial to the so-called victims of the Cold War. But we're just going to have to cover that another time. I'd like to thank our three scholars, Ellen Schrecker, John Wiener, and Doug Becker. Thank you all so much. John Wiener is a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, and his latest, How We Forgot the Cold War, A Historical Journey Across America. Ellen Schrecker is a professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of several books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and The Age of McCarthyism, A Brief History with Documents. Doug Becker is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Among his publications are The Bush Administration's Campaign Against the International Criminal Court and also Memory and Trauma in International Relations. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.